And welcome back to the Offspring Magazine, the podcast. It's Bea, and I will be hosting today's podcast. Today we will talk to Professor Bjorn Stevens, who is a director of the department The Atmosphere in the Earth's System at the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany. Today's conversation is about climate change and what a climate science expert thinks about this topic. In part one, which was released last week, we talked specifically about Professor Stevens' research on clouds and water vapor and how they play an important role in our atmosphere, including how they affect climate change. Today, we will talk about climate change in more general terms. We will talk about whether extreme weather events are becoming worse, how we study whether these extreme weather events are due to climate change, what are some of the biggest misconceptions, how much do we really know about climate change, and what are some of the best ways forward. I hope you will enjoy this podcast. So, what about these extreme weather events? Can you talk a bit about those? Just because a lot of times in the media you see that there's like an increase in extreme weather events happening right now, which are because of climate change. So is that also something that you study, or can you just give your opinion on that?
Yeah, I wouldn't say I studied a lot, but I do spend not a small amount of time thinking about it because it's sort of a motivation. If you think of, if you heat the system up, you're just going to kind of sample a wider range of things in a sort of naive way. But you can think about that as the Earth as a whole. If you're heating the Earth up, it's just kind of, it has a capacity to maintain more water vapor. Everything becomes a bit more exaggerated in a way. So on some very basic level, it doesn't come as a surprise that an example, the only state where nothing happens is a state of absolute zero if you take that. So the hotter the system is, the kind of more that can happen. You can kind of think of it that way, but that's a far away from being able to say, well, we're actually seeing more extremes, more tornadoes, more hurricanes, more floods, more heat waves, more droughts. Some people even say more cold snaps out of, a funny argument. And that's really hard to say because we're talking about things that happen fairly rarely. And so how do you test these ideas? So people, of course, will run a model and they'll show that the model makes more extremes, but
but
that's at most a first step. And I think being specific with extremes, and in the end, and it's something that makes an extreme is that it has impact. And impact is this coincidence of something unusual happening somewhere unusual. So if you have a heat wave over the ocean, it might affect the biology of the ocean, but it's different than if you had a heat wave over New York City.
That's like the, this happened like last year or 2 years ago where they had that volcano close to New Zealand. They had that volcano that happened like in the ocean, which just, in the end didn't have an effect really. But
imagine if that went off in
exactly,
Brooklyn,
Exactly.
So that would be it. So the extremes are really, and they affect different things different ways, right? So they're hard. To understand how extremes will change and how that will impact society. You can even take a step back and you can say, well, forget about Earth changing, how susceptible, in China you see all these cities have kind of risen up out of nothing over the last 20 years, and in Africa they're hot at it in terms of making, there's a lot of urbanization happening in Africa, so some of the biggest growing cities, most of the biggest growing big cities are in Africa at the moment. And are they vulnerable to extremes? Because they're building these huge urban areas and there's not a long record of measurement there, So how often when you build a giant city in the north of Nigeria, how often do they have record floods? No one really knows. They weren't measuring. And so trying to understand the vulnerability of infrastructure investments, people, two extremes, and then on top of that, trying to understand the future vulnerability of people to extremes because the climate's changing, is a big deal because it has to do with huge investments, but it's also a very challenging problem.
Okay.
So I think in general you can say, well, there's good reasons to expect as the planet warms that you would see more extremes, but that's not really that helpful. Because if you want to deal with this, you want to know, you can just close your eyes and say, we don't want it to warm. That'd be nice.
Yeah.
But the reality is it's going to warm. And we'd like to be able to scientifically to help people adapt to this or to make wise choices about how we invest in infrastructure. You know, so
yeah.
I work in Barbados a fair amount. And there they have the choice. Can they invest their money in protecting them against floods because it's going to rain too much, or desalinization because it will rain too little and they need fresh water. So those are two very different decisions. So what do you do? That's
yeah,
not even
do
extreme.
Do?
Well, they built desalinization for a while. People said it was going to get drier, but then it kind of,
yeah.
There's this one news report I found, it was really great. They had to stop working on their desalinization plant because it was raining so much in the dry season.
Yeah.
Right? You know, so...
Yeah.
So can you do this more intelligently, or do you just kind of have to iterate your way through?
Yeah.
Maybe that's it. You just have to prepare for everything and kind of let time select, you know. So you try to do both, but normally you can't do both in a lot of places, so, yeah.
But you do think that with the global temperatures rising, we should prepare for potentially an increase in extreme weather events. Or it's just so hard to say. In the end, you just have to invest in the science to find new solutions to kind of protect you.
Yeah, I probably use that word should a lot, but I always try to avoid the should.
A lot of what you see in the media right now is there's more hurricanes right now, or more extreme hurricanes.
Probably depends what papers you read.
That's actually,
right?
That could be.
If you read The Guardian, then... You know, The Guardian took it upon them. I read The Guardian, they took it on themselves they felt like they had a social imperative to warn people about climate change. So a few years ago, they made it a point to really keep climate change in the public eye. And other papers kind of feel just as compelled to kind of talk down the climate change. So the media is often following an agenda that they have, and so you do read about extremes because people like reading about extremes.
Yeah,
it's fun. So
it's fun.
It,
it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And if you can tie the extremes to climate change, then it also fits a point of view that which makes it really hard for normal people just to figure out what's really going on.
So that was actually my next question as well. You as an expert. Like, I guess you can read a bunch of news articles and know, like, oh, this is not true, or this is the right one to read. Whereas normal people, I mean, you look at everything, you see so many different opinions.
Yeah, it's very speculative
on
the extremes. And I think the science is still very speculative, especially these...
So the science is still speculative.
Yeah, I think it's the science isn't helping us here. You know, I think you can use the principle that if you don't know what's going on, you probably shouldn't mess with things too much. So I would tend to be conservative in the sense that you know, why would you want to heat up the planet 2 degrees if you don't really have a good understanding of what that means? You can't evaluate the trade-offs. So that would lead me, from this point of view, to be saying we should reduce emissions. And I think that's a perfectly, you know, good argument to make. Other people think that they're in a public relations situation where they have to convince the public something really bad will happen if they don't do it, rather than saying something bad could happen.
Mm.
And they think that's the only way to make sure that collectively we as humans behave in their eyes responsibly to, you know, guard against the risk. But it's really a risk calculation, and there's some things where we have... I mean, in general, there's things that we do know, you know, so things will happen, but not in a way that we really know where and when and how strong. We would expect you know, the amount of rainfall you can produce in a storm will increase with temperature. And we know that. I mean,
yeah.
You don't need to be a climate scientist to know that. You just see how hard it rains in winter compared to summer. I mean,
yeah.
Go to the tropics and you'll just get nailed by a torrential storm. And that's just basic physics. So there's some general things we know about extremes, which make you realize that as you have a warmer world, the extremes will change in a certain way. You know, this idea of, like, if you look in the Mediterranean and imagine that the, you know, in the Mediterranean, you tend to have winter rains and summer dry. That's a sort of typical climate pattern. And so if you have a lot of rain in the winter, because the rainier things rain more, and there's good reason to you can explain that with that water vapor argument I gave about how much water you can hold in the atmosphere, depends on temperature. So the difference between saturation and dry is larger. That means that when you're saturated, it's got much more water, and when you're dry, it's relatively much more drier. So that means when it rains in the winter, it rains more, and when it's dry in the summer, it dries out quicker. And that's just a wonderful ingredient for making fire, because you just grow a bunch of fuel in the winter and then you can burn it in the summer. So you kind of expect these things to happen, and you can kind of go out and say, well, they'll happen everywhere all the time. Or you might want to say, actually, you know, there's ways in which we can plan for that. And that's the scientific challenge, is trying to be more specific about extremes. So and normally when you read about extremes in the paper, and that's where I may be coming across a little bit more skeptically, is that they're often talking about the specific, and they're using the general as the argument. You know, just because in general this happens doesn't mean that this storm wouldn't have happened without this tendency. And we can't really show that this storm or that storm or three of these storms, it's very hard to show that these are really due to warming. Some of these things will happen without warming.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, how do we know, like, how many of the weather events, for example, are due to anthropogenic warming, and how many are due to just natural variability?
I can tell you how people calculate that, and then you can decide if you believe it or not.
Okay.
So they take a model, and they try to make a model simulate something like was observed. And normally it doesn't look that much like what was observed. It's sort of close.
Yeah.
Or you just take a model and you take, you know, you had a flood. So you take a model and you make it have the same flood. Same flood in the sense that it was, you know, a 10th percentile flood or one of the most extreme floods that we've measured. And then you can ask yourself in the model, well, if we look at this similar sort of thing, how often would have this have happened if we hadn't had warming and if we do have warming? So you can play these sort of counterfactual games. But it all relies on your model being correct. And we know the models are wrong. So the question is, are they wrong in a way that makes that quantification difficult? And I always think, like, when you read that in the paper, you should ask, what's the, if they say that storm was 30% more likely in a warmer climate, 30% plus or minus what? You know, it's not like they can calculate 30%, but, you know, and until you can put a error bar on your estimate, it's not really an estimate.
Yeah.
Because it could be 30 plus or minus 200%, then is it really saying anything? And often it is 30% more likely plus or minus 200%.
Yeah.
You know, so really it could have been, you know, 3 out of 5 times, you know, it could very well have been less likely given the uncertainty of the measurement, you know, so.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's a good example for people, but if I say, you know, I see a person on the street and I say they're 2 meters, or, you know, I say, oh, you know, can you give this book to, you know, our friend Joe? And you say, I don't know Joe. And I say, well, he looks like this and he's 2 meters tall. Then you kind of think I knew 2 meters. But if I really meant, you know, well, he's somewhere between 50 centimeters and 4 meters, then that would be completely useless information to tell you that he was 2 meters tall. Anyway, so this attribution stuff, people like to hear it. People want to read about it. But I'm kind of skeptical about I think we just like talking about climate change, to be honest.
Well, yeah, it's a hugely politicized topic right now. It's just everywhere. Everyone's talking about it. So many different opinions.
Because we're not doing anything about it. You see, I think you talk about things, you don't do things about. So we much prefer to talk about it because it maybe it makes us feel better about not doing anything about it. I don't know.
So do you not think that we're doing enough for climate change? And if you obviously say no to that answer, then what do you think we could do about it? Or what more could we do about it?
So I think climate change is a class of, let's call them Anthropocene problems. So, and then you can say, well, what's the Anthropocene? And so we think of the Anthropocene as this age where individual actions scale globally. And so most people talk about it as sort of the imprint of humans geologically on the whole earth, like in terms of pollution. But you also see it in finance. You know, you couldn't have had the amount of wealth that Jeff Bezos has comes from the fact that he just can't sell in his town, or he just can't sell in his country, but he can sell his products worldwide. So you've just increased the scale at which how people can scale their activities globally. And when people individually can imprint themselves on the planet globally, whether it's in finance or pollution, or terror or whatever, and you don't have a way to regulate that, you create problems. And so a lot of the problems we have are, on one hand, this ability to scale globally, so we emit CO2, and it affects the world globally. If it only affected something locally, then you can deal with that. You know, like if it's only in the house and somebody is, you know, I don't know, not opening the window in the bathroom or something, then you can make a rule that says you have to open the window in the bathroom, or they're not doing their dishes. You can say you have to do the dishes. And then there's all sorts of procedures for doing that. So we can solve those conflicts locally, not perfectly, but roughly.
Yeah.
We can solve it in communities, you know, if people are behaving poorly in public, or they're, you know, using unfair business practices, or they're not, you know, paying taxes or whatever. We can solve that in the community, we can solve that nationally. But the problems we have aren't people, it's not that people aren't doing dishes, they're just not doing everyone's dishes globally, right? You know, and we haven't figured out how to govern ourselves globally.
Yeah.
And global governance, most people, sounds frightening. Because, you know, that's sort of like, oh my goodness, it's even worse than. But on the other hand, we have these problems which are global, and I don't know that we've come to terms with that, the fact that we have global problems that we have to solve globally, and we just don't know how to do it, and we're just kind of looking away from that.
So it's like every country is kind of dealing with it, but within that country,
or not dealing with it,
or not dealing with
yeah.
it, but we should rather be like all coming together and.
Yeah, but that's so much easier said than done.
I mean, it's impossible, basically.
Yeah. So that's where I just don't know how this will. So one way that this works itself out is that we find technological remedies. So that's one hope that people have is if technology comes up with solutions that make it easy to avoid a problem, and there's lots of examples of that, I guess, in the past, although don't press me on one.
I was just going to ask you, give an example, but no, it's...
You know, maybe with CFCs is the example
yeah.
that people use, you know, or now we're seeing with electric cars that we can... they're really
example.
Growing, you know, and
yeah.
so when we can do certain things technologically, then we don't have to solve them socially.
Yes.
And so if... That's a way a remedy could happen, is that it just becomes more attractive to do things a different way, and we get out of the problem that way. If it really comes push to shove where we have to make rules...
Well, it's not worked so far.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that would work because I don't see...
Yeah.
But
then, yeah, so this is where I agree with that, or I'm more of the opinion that we should really be looking for solutions to problems, and this is where we should have to rely on science, and this
mm-hmm.
is where I'm also optimistic that science will be able to find certain solutions.
Yeah.
Because if we just go via the we need to reduce emissions, and you know, we need to do this and this, and people need to follow those things, I just don't see that being very efficient.
Yeah, I don't see that happening, and so we could all wish it. But
yeah.
wishing something is very different than getting it. Doesn't mean that we shouldn't try, but our focus should be how can we incentivize good behavior, and how can we incentivize good solutions, rather than how can we attempt to regulate might be the wrong word, but even, you know, it's hard to be moralistic about it, you know, because with, you know, saying people shouldn't, it's a lot. I mean, how can, it's hard to tell other people what they should do, you know, you need to present them with better choices and have faith that they will make the good choices, but trying to make the choice for them, I find always, it's not a very successful strategy. And so if we build our strategy on a sort of making a choice for people, it doesn't seem like a winning strategy to me.
The biggest problem that I have with that is that in the end it's the politicians that make the decision for you, because they're the ones that make the decision. But then what influences what the politicians want you to do is in the end the public's opinion.
Yeah, exactly.
Because politicians will do anything to be in power. So in the end, what you want, which might not be the best, is in the end what they will tell you to do, because they want to stay in power.
Yeah, that's where I think with some people, who knows if I see this right, but some people kind of, like you said, they think that what politicians do is that they try to tell people what to do or regulate society, but mostly they're just, the job of a politician mostly is to get reelected.
Yeah.
That's what they do. And then so it's kind of reverse, you know, the politicians are really trying to sense within their moral comfort zone, you know, but they're trying to figure out how to get elected. And so there's a little bit of nudging going on in a positive way. And also with the media, you know, a lot of people think that the media exists to inform the public. So the media, there's this idea in people's head that the media sells information to the public. But really, the media sells consumers, readers, watchers to the advertisers. So what the media sells is not information, they sell readers. And when you realize that, it changes your whole view on, because what they then show people is the thing that elects them, allows them to collect the things they can sell the best, right? They want certain types of readers. They want readers which are affluent, which they can then auction to advertisers. Yeah. They want readers who are open with their data, because if they auction someone who has lots of linked data to them, then, you know, when you read something, I was informed about that the other day, when you go, when you read the web, you're auctioned. Immediately when you click on a newspaper story, you're sent to an auction.
Oh, wow.
They say, I have this person with this sort of data.
How
much will advertiser A, B, C, or D pay me to show them their ad?
Yeah.
And so not all readers are equal, and all of us are being auctioned all the time by the media. And we think somehow we're, you know, the information the media is doing is just sort of secondary. It's the way of auctioning us. And so they want to get a lot of readers. They want to get a lot of valuable readers. They want readers with lots of data. But in the end, they're just trying to make as much money as possible. And the politicians are just trying to get elected as much as possible. And that's the reality.
And
so,
science papers aren't open access. So that's...
But I think open access is overrated.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How come?
Because, it inverts that thing. Open access is just a trick of publishers to make more money.
Yeah.
You know, because it used to be that you would sell content to readers, libraries, other scientists. And if you double the amount of content, then it costs you more. And so you had to charge more. But if the readers didn't want that content, then you couldn't sell it to them. So there is a really natural filter, a content filter. It had lots of problems, which open access tried to address, but I think in a poor way. So what it did was it made it, you know, it was a content filter, which made sure that the supply was driven by demand. So, you know, by making it supply driven, the publishers can publish, it scales infinitely. And that's why you see publishing exploding, because if you make the producers pay, if the model is the producers pay or the public pays, which is in the end, because it comes from tax dollars, then the publishers just win-win, because they can just, there's no disincentive for publishing more. Because how much money you make depends on how much you publish, because you're charging the public for that. So I think open access went about solving a real problem in a way that actually was more designed to enrich the publishers than it was to inform the society.
So how would you go about...
Well, we have it, you see. For a lot of the publications, there's laws, which
yeah.
says the intellectual rights of the articles are open. Everyone can publish on the web preprints
yeah.
of their things.
That's
so there's nothing in the
yeah.
way of making things open.
Yeah.
And if the journals want to select some papers, package them, and sell them to readers, then they can do that. And then you can decide. We can decide if we want to buy them as libraries or not. But there's no, there's nothing inhibiting
yeah.
open access. You know, so this open access is really, we call it open access, but in more times than not, it's pay the publisher.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I see.
Yeah,
I
so
hadn't really thought about it.
Yeah, so it's a whole system that seems really, that they're always the worst, the things that seem like a really good idea. Because who could be against open access? You
well,
know?
Yeah, and then if you are against open access, then you're the bad guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
can't say that you're
right.
against it.
Right, but I think open access has gone wrong. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, for me, with especially with climate change, it's sometimes hard to find the right things to read just because
yeah.
I can't. Most of the papers are either too complicated to read or I don't have access to them.
Yeah.
And then there's the media.
Yeah, yeah.
There's nothing kind of like, you know, in between.
Right.
But this is where I guess podcasts also.
Yeah, yeah, that's what we're doing here.
Yeah, exactly. In the end, you're talking to the expert
yeah.
and it is open access. Like
yeah.
It's
yeah.
available to everyone.
Yeah.
So, what are some of kind of the big misconceptions about climate change that you think are floating around?
That 1.5 is really much different than 2 degrees.
Okay.
So we know, so here's a question I ask people, in what way is 2 degrees different than 4/3 of 1.5 degree? Yeah. So
I don't
it's,
know.
Yeah, it's just 4/3 of 1.5. And there's some things like the water vapor equation that I was talking about that scale exponentially
yeah.
with temperature. So then it's 4/3 inside the exponential.
Yeah.
But, you know, can we really say that 1.5 degrees is sort of somehow fundamentally, you know, we're safe at 1.5 degrees and we're not safe at 2 degrees? That's
yeah.
that's communicated a lot as if these temperature thresholds have a real scientific meaning, and they're political devices to help focus the debate, you know, because people like a target. So, you know, people who study communication and you know, but it's really just a political tool that people use to shape the debate.
But don't we...
There's nothing really... I mean, the warmer it gets, the less we know about the future, and with that comes more risk. So
yeah.
obviously warmer is worse than colder. But that's, you know, if we used a different temperature scale, instead of 1.5 degrees, why don't we use 3 degrees Fahrenheit and 5 degrees Fahrenheit? You could use those. Those would be fine. It's kind of like this Abstand, you know, in Germany, we with
yeah.
the letters 1.5, 2 meters. Clear 2 meters is better than 1.5, but it's nothing magic that happens at 1.5. It, you know, is the room closed and stuff like that. So
yeah.
it's, and it, so the misconception is that there's something magic, like everything's okay at 1.5.
Yeah.
Certainly 1.5 is better than 2.
But just because we don't know what's going to happen at 2, and I guess you increase your risk.
Right, right.
But
so
there's not a specific reason.
Yeah, yeah. So that it's not like we're safe at 1.5. You know, they're often posed in the media as, you know, if we keep temperatures to 1.5, we're safe. It's just that if we're at 1.5, we're better than at 2. And 2 is better than 3. But
yeah.
But exactly how, you know, and then some people like to... They try to quantify the risk between 1.5 and 2, and that's what we're not very good at. So if you ask, how much more expensive would a 2 degree world be compared to a 1.5 degree world? Of course, people can make models and do calculations, but I don't think there's really a good scientific basis for.
Yeah.
Because
there's too many unknowns.
Yeah, there's So misconception, I guess you asked about misconception. So I guess the misconception would really be that there's something magic about these numbers, you know, that they're sort of scientific. They're scientific in the sense that we know that 2 is 4/3 of 1.5,
mm-hmm.
i.e. bigger, you know?
Yeah.
And the bigger it gets, the more risks come with it. But that's about as far as we go with it. It's not like there's, you know, some theory that says at 2 degrees, the ice sheets will collapse and at 1.5 they won't.
Yeah.
You know, the risk that they'll collapse is higher at 2. Obviously, it's warmer than 1.5. Yeah, so that's a misconception that somehow that the these temperature targets have a there's a popular perception that they have a stronger scientific foundation than what I just explained to you.
Okay.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a misconception. There's lots of misconceptions about science. You know, I always like the Greta's. I'm a fan of Greta, I must say, but you know, she says, listen to the science.
Mm.
It doesn't mean, and so if anyone's listening to this, it doesn't mean listen to me, the scientist, right? So listen to the science means somehow being able to digest the stuff that comes from scientists, which is robust.
Yeah.
You know? So
I guess for me, listen to the science just means like listen to the data, right?
Yeah, when it's clear. But
yeah.
Often when we see, like, you know, just I guess all of us have tried to follow the COVID thing and tried to figure out how to, and there's some things that are clear, but there's many things where it's a bit unclear.
Yes.
About what to do. And you read this study and you read that study.
Yeah.
And we're arguing about it. And then suddenly you see it from a different light. And so science is really about arguing, and arguments can be more settled or less settled. And once in a while we do settle an argument, we understand that the planet's warming and we understand it's from greenhouse gases and it's pretty simple. We know the Earth is going around the sun. I mean, there's things that science can kind of definitively say, and you want to be able to sort those out. And there's other things where we're in the midst of a hot argument. And sometimes if you translate, listen, the best thing is not listen. Listen to the science can really quickly be an authoritarian way of interacting with the world, because, you know, listen to God, listen to your mother, listen to the science. And really, I'd like to understand listen to the science is listen to the reason. And the reason should be something that makes sense to you.
Yeah.
And then you say, this is how I understand it, and this is why I think this is like this, and I learned to understand it because people who worked at it taught me this, and I can follow their reason. It can still be wrong, but it should be reason-based rather than authority-based.
Yeah.
And the beauty of the science is that it's a system of reasoning. And so we should really lift the reasoning up and not the authority. But that's a lot to ask of people too, because people want to spend time thinking about other things, you know.
Yeah.
They wanna, yeah. So on, in the end, we all try to figure out who we can trust, and we listen to them.
Yeah.
So
we've talked about 1.5 degrees going to 2, and so one of the ways to prevent how to do that is to reduce emissions. I guess that's one of the ways, right? So, and we live in Germany. And nuclear energy is always a topic I like to talk to a lot of people about, particularly in Germany, since we phased out all nuclear power plants.
Yeah.
So what do you think is the best way to reduce emissions? And we don't need to be looking only at Germany. Like we said, we should probably be looking at a global solution to reduce emissions.
Yeah.
Would this be nuclear energy, renewable energy?
So it seems like, yeah, I don't do a lot with energy politics. I always kind of joke that, you know, Germany doesn't really need nuclear because we have France.
Yeah, exactly.
If they have a big industry, that's their sort of competitive advantage.
Yeah.
So just get the nuclear from France. And then, I mean, we're a networked European continent. So if whatever reason it doesn't work to have nuclear in Germany, then and then people can argue about the transport effectiveness of having all the nuclear in France or something like that. One of the things I think on energy where the because these problems are intertwined with the other ones I mentioned of inequality and development and just using the full human potential that we have on the planet, I don't know. I never understood why we couldn't use climate change as also a development exercise. And my example would be if you go to the Caribbean. I mentioned I work a lot in Barbados.
Yeah.
They have all sorts of, it's energy wonderland there, right? You have infinite sun.
Yeah.
super wind on the volcanic islands. You have geothermal, you have hydropower because of the rain and the islands. And most of them, they get their energy from Venezuela and Trinidad and Tobago oil. And they ship it in and they burn it. And that's because the infrastructure, you can use old infrastructure, it's cheap. And they get it fairly cheaply. But if we're serious about climate change, then how can we make Barbados energy efficient? So I think the rich countries should adopt developing countries and do it in a way that's sustainable, not just that, you know, you ship in a bunch of Danish, you know, wind turbines there, build them up, and then they start falling apart, you know, but really build the wind turbines in the Caribbean and found Caribbean firms that actually develop the technology, if it's wind turbines or solar cells, but really trying to make a concerted effort to work with the sort of under-resourced part of the world to let them be energy efficient. You could say, well, you know, they don't use a lot of energy, so that doesn't save a lot. But I think in the long term...
Oh, but they will.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing. That's what a lot of people don't realize. Like, we need a lot of energy because if you want them to develop, they will require loads of energy.
Yeah. So I thought for me, a serious approach would be to couple that with a development strategy. And we can talk all about here in Germany how many wind turbines we want. And we can talk all about, you know, how do we meet our carbon budget, but why can't we get two things at once and make it part of a broader development strategy? But then you really have to go back to the question of how do you do these things too in a way that isn't just a hidden way of subsidizing call it first world companies, because a lot of development aid, as I see it, is just a way, you know, the way it would work is you'd go to Barbados and say, oh, let's make you renewable, so you need wind turbines, and like I said, then you say, okay, then buy them from Siemens. And they're made in Germany, and then you create a dependency, and it's not sustainable, and it's really just a way of the taxpayer giving Siemens money, you know, filtered through Barbados.
Yeah.
So you don't want to do that. You'd like it to be a really organic approach, so you...
Which is very difficult.
But if we can't do that...
Yeah.
Then the rest is all fantasy anyway.
Yeah.
You know? So why not begin... trying to do that. That would be nothing against rethinking how we approach energy in Europe or in Germany.
I mean, it makes a lot more sense to put solar panels in Africa, for example, as opposed to Germany. We get no sun here.
Right.
In Africa, it's constant.
Yeah, exactly. But you need, you know, the problem there is that you bite into the whole structural problems that we have in the world and development problems, and I don't think people really have an appetite for taking on these issues. But if we don't take on these issues, I have a hard time seeing how, you know, maybe the argument is if we just develop in technologies in Europe for renewables, they'll be so cheap and easy to use, then they'll filter down, you know, to the developing countries. Maybe there's an argument to be made there.
I see that because that tends to happen. Like, we developed cell phones and now they have them as well, but only because we developed them quickly and made them also cheap enough.
Right.
For them to have. So I see that argument.
Yeah. So that, you know, that could be an argument. So in Germany, it's kind of tough, isn't it? You know, because I think a lot of people like to talk about nuclear. I have some good friends who are staunch advocates of nuclear.
They're not Germans, though, right?
No, they're not Germans. But they're still, they all talk about fourth generation nuclear and things like this, which is still a bit, seems like a bit of a fantasy, because it's where we could go. And if South Korea develops this nuclear, then fine. We'll just end up buying, you know, if there's a safe nuclear... And people have it, but nuclear is, it's normally, a lot of these things are subsidized. People, there's a lot of money behind nuclear, and there's a lot of money to be made. So nuclear has very powerful friends. There's enough countries developing nuclear. If you can come up with safe nuclear, wait till South Korea does it. And then people say, oh, but then South Korea will do it. Fine, you know, so I don't feel like Germany needs to compete with South Korea. We should pick our spots in technology, and if France does it, that's their competitive, if they come up with really great nuclear technology, but it's not like France has been so successful in building putting new nuclear reactors online.
Yeah.
And again, just like all the other renewables, if somebody comes up with a way to that addresses the problems of nuclear, then maybe it won't be so hard to convince Germans. And maybe then, you know, the world will be making nuclear energy and there won't be German firms doing it. But I guess German firms will make some of the pieces. So I wonder sometimes why people get so worked up about the fact that Germany's not doing, among my friends, not doing nuclear, because, you know, why does everyone have to do it? German will do the wind and other people can do it. And I have a feeling they just want that investment.
Yeah.
You know, they
I guess nuclear just generates so much more energy than wind and solar, particularly in places like Germany. So I think that's probably the main argument.
Yeah, but we could, there's nothing against having nuclear in Germany if there's a good nuclear solution.
Mm.
But it's not, it's not like there is one right now. It's not like anybody's making cheap reactors, which you don't have to subsidize. You know, you couldn't insure.
Yeah.
A reactor.
Yeah, exactly.
You can insure a windmill. So I have another, a good friend who I respect tremendously, but he talks about the number of people who have died from coal. And he's right, it's enormous because it's not insured in their downstream consequences. But wind turbines, if a wind turbine breaks and kills someone, the state, I don't think, here I'm just talking from guesswork, but I guess the wind turbines are insured by the people who put them up. So if the wind turbine breaks down and the blade goes off and chops into someone's house and kills their cow, then the person who had the wind turbine will be liable for that and have to buy a new cow and roof and whatever, right? That doesn't work with nuclear, that the state has to subsidize it. And I think that's a pretty good measure. You know, if somebody has a technology that they're able to insure, then, and that's an argument against coal too, because you can't insure it and it does kill a lot of people. If coal companies had to be liable for their emissions, we wouldn't have coal. So they're also living on a giant subsidy, a public subsidy, that we're kind of accommodating their emissions. Yeah, so nuclear would be great, but it should be a solution that we believe.
Yeah.
You know, in the sense, and believe it means that if we require the state to insure it because no reasonable person would, you know, insure that, that's to me kind of saying we don't believe it. So if someone comes up with technology where you can burn the fuel down and burn it and burn it, like this fourth generation seems promising. Maybe it will do that, but if it doesn't, then maybe there'll be a basis for reevaluating of building those plants. But right now it's not like there's a plant that we can build in Germany that you know, and even in the nuclear countries, like I said, they have a hard time building plants in France and
Speaking about solutions, actually, I just thought about, like, so you know how in Dubai they like artificially make it rain? Because they put...
They try,
does not work so well?
Well, I don't know. I haven't looked into it in enough detail. I know they try. I know there's a lot of skepticism about how effective that is. I'm sure they have examples where that works.
And that's... how does it even work? I think it's like these...
They have all sorts of different approaches to do that. Yeah.
So but I guess it's just you put like chemicals or...
Well, the old idea, sometimes you can... The best way is, you know, rain forms because of the way the air moves. So you need to change the way the air moves. What they try to do, because basically you have to bring moisture and condense it and it has to fall down. And if the air's not going up and condensing moisture, you know, there's one way. If the air is going up and making moisture and it's not falling down, then you can try to do things that can initiate this process that makes the rain form out of the moisture. But you need this, you need the moisture. Yeah. And so that's the bigger problem normally, is how to get the convergence of moisture that then you can do the other things to make it fall down. So if you have a lot of big clouds there and they're just, you know, not raining soon enough, but they drift offshore and rain, you probably can kind of help them along so that they rain a little more.
What about doing the opposite? So it's like in places where there's a lot of rainfall.
Yeah.
You try to like put chemicals or particulate matter in the air that prevents the rain from falling. Could that technology be used to prevent certain natural disasters? Maybe even like the flooding that happened in Germany last year.
Yeah, you know, that for a long time in the 50s, people had this idea that you could yeah, well, 50s maybe is the wrong year, but in the last century, say, you know, by putting oil slicks down on the ocean, you could stop hurricanes from getting the heat that they wanted, you know, by making...
Oh, I did not hear that.
Yeah, so if you could smooth the ocean, you could stop hurricanes. There's been ideas that you could explode atomic bombs.
Well, that seems a lot more difficult because, one, you need to... In the 1950s, it would have probably been a lot harder to know exactly where the hurricane was.
Right,
and it's also hurricanes are not very predictable.
Yeah.
And two, the ocean's just so big.
Yeah. So my point more was in general that looking for these sort of technological solutions to... So let's do another one. The geoengineering, where people have this idea, geoengineering is this idea that you can put...
Yeah.
Particulate in the stratosphere, right? And if you have the particulate in the stratosphere, then it would stop the sunlight from coming to the ground. And people debate about whether this will happen, and whether it would be good, and whether you could detect it, and whether it would be effective, and all of these things. That's all fine. Then I go to myself, though, and I say, okay, imagine we could do it. Imagine it was effective. We could do it. It was good, all of these things. And we did it. And we did it starting on the 1st of January, 2021. And on the 15th of July, we had the floods in Ahrweiler,
mm-hmm.
in the German region.
Yeah, it's where I've come
okay,
from.
Yeah.
I had them right there.
Okay. So imagine that happened. And actually, it wasn't we doing it, Germany, but it was Russia who was doing it, or something like that. I guess there'd be people who would say that this flood was because of what they
did.
Or that, you know, in 2000, I don't know what year that was, they had these giant floods in Pakistan.
Okay.
But every year there's these extreme weather that happens. How would you litigate that?
Mm.
You know, because the people would... So, and there again, this difficulty we have in regulating global systems makes it hard. So that the sort of international framework that you would need to have that would allow you to regulate these sorts of conflicts... is the one that we're missing to solve the global warming problem.
Yeah.
So to me, if you could manage that, then you can manage the simpler problem of reducing emissions. So in your example of let's stop this terrible flood, but imagine if you intervene in that way, there's a chance that something else happens. And so you induce a liability that goes beyond the local control.
Yeah.
And then you need precisely those sorts of international frameworks to resolve conflicts that we... are missing to solve the CO2 problem.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes
sense. It makes, yeah, no, it does make sense. I actually didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
That, I don't know, if you artificially change the way the atmosphere works, that you might do some more damage that you can't really predict for.
Yeah, so the collateral. And even if you don't,
exactly.
You have to be able to show that you don't. Otherwise, people will try to hold you liable. And that happens every time you do something on purpose. We tend not to hold people liable if we do things inadvertently. Like we're changing the atmosphere all the time when we, you know, change our crop rotation or build our cities differently or change our coastlines. So we're changing, you know, the natural environment is far from natural. It's every space on the earth is influenced by humans. But the changes haven't been, in most cases, directly intended to modify something. I mean, here in Hamburg we have the Elbe, and we dredge the Elbe, which makes the region more susceptible to floods.
Yeah.
And we know that, but it doesn't, you know, that's still in our local governorable.
Wait, sorry, what did you do to the Elbe?
The Elbe, we dredge it so the big ships can go up and down.
Oh, right, yeah.
And so we take that and deepen it and dredge it, and that makes the...
Yeah.
It tends to make the channel deeper, and it can affect the high and low water marks. It affects the local landscape. So it has collateral influences, but they're local. And when you start doing things on large-scale floods, then maybe you stop the flood, but then it floods in Poland or something like that. And And so how do you protect yourself against that? That's where I kind of think these are distractions, because we talk about like geoengineering or we talk about intervening, but they're kind of fail for the reasons the more easy things or the more straightforward things fail, which is this lack of inability to build a global consensus about what we should do.
Shame. I thought I had a million dollar idea. Not joking. And so in Dubai, how do they get more moisture?
I've always asked to kind of review these proposals and participate in these programs.
Just because it's so dry there.
Yeah.
So, curious.
I don't know. And I also don't know the economics of it because it's dry, but there's also a lot of money that they have. So they might be able to trade money for water.
That's funny.
Yeah.
That's funny.
Have a lot of sun, so desalinization seems like that would win in the end anyway.
That's actually true.
Desalinization is mostly just a question of energy.
Yeah.
And
they have a lot of sun.
Yeah. So I don't understand why that's not a better way to make water. And it is in Israel. I know that the amount of desalinization that happens in Israel is enormous.
Does it happen a lot?
Yeah. And it's become much... in the last 20 or 30 years, I think desalinization has become much more cost effective.
Yeah.
And if you're in any energy rich, I mean, solar rich place, I think there's lots of potential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Nice. Okay, well, thank you very much for this talk.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. I had a lot of fun. And yeah, good luck with your research.
Yeah, thanks very much.
That's it. Thank you all so much for listening. If you would like to learn more about Professor Stevens and his research, you can look at his website. And if you like our podcasts, make sure to follow us on our Twitter, LinkedIn, and Instagram page. Thanks again for listening. Bye! Offspring Magazine, the podcast, is brought to you by the Maximum PhD Net Science Communication Group, known as the Offspring Magazine. The intro-outro music is composed by Serena Frankumar, and the pre-intro jingle is composed by Gustavo Carrizo. If you have any feedback, comments, or suggestions, please feel free to write us at offspring.podcast@phenet.mpg.de. Until next week, stay safe, stay healthy. Bye!